Welcome, everyone. I'm John O'Loughlin. Welcome to McDuff Lives, and thank you for joining us on Facebook, Twitter, McDuff Lives 2 on YouTube, and also our brand new channel, our flagship channel now at McDuff Lives, all one word, at Rumble. And thank you all for joining the Rumble. We had a very good attendance in the last few shows, and a lot of views afterwards, too. So I'm keeping an eye on the statistics as we continue to build our brand as much as we can. Marcia, a terrific addition to our productions, and she'll be contributing more and more as time goes on and, you know, everything works out. She is a very talented producer for radio, television, and has a whole lot of great talent. You probably noticed she has a terrific radio voice also. So we'll be trying to get her back on camera again soon. Finally succeeded, and she did a great job last night. So thank you, Marcia, and congratulations on being your first on-screen personality appearance here at McDuff Lives. Happy birthday to Renner in our chat room, Renner Newton. Thank you for being here. And hello to Robert and Corky and Nadia, Steel Magnolia, Laura. Christy is here, and some other folks may be over at the other chat room, but I'm going to get into my content right now. You all understand the problem that I can't see all the chat room at once. So, and while we want to migrate away from YouTube, unfortunately, they have the most friendly platform for our chat room, and I'm not going to do without my chat room. I love you guys, and I'm glad you're there. Well, sometimes I do have to, like Mark Kulak does, is not look at it so I can concentrate on the content that I want to present. So that's what we did last night. Thanks for your indulgence there. But we'll have a chat tomorrow, a live chat at 11 a.m. So make sure and bring your questions and comments about this week's work and the items in the news and anything else you want to talk about, history, politics, philosophy. I'm open tomorrow, a.m., 11 a.m. Eastern time. So I have a number of excerpts I'm going to talk about today, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to reach any conclusions as to why or when or how this whole Ukraine thing is going to develop. I do watch battlefield reports every day, and it looks like a huge battle is forming right now where, you know, perhaps 80,000 Ukrainians will be assaulting against 50 to 80,000 Russians in these borderline cities or towns where the Russian occupation forces have been trying to take the entire oblast or provinces that they have claimed that are now part of sovereign Russia, as opposed to the NATO forces that are supporting Zelensky. And it's going to be a hell of a battle, I'm afraid. A lot of people are going to lose their lives. So why? What's behind it? Why is this horrible battle happening, you know, so long after World War II? Haven't we sorted all this stuff out yet? No, we have not sorted it out yet. One of the first books that I've read on my show, my first show, McDuff Kennedy's Man to Smash the CIA, following Fletcher Prouty's secret team, is this book, Blowback, by Christopher Simpson. Now, I have not sought to interview Christopher Simpson because, well, I just haven't gotten to it. He's a professor at American University, and hopefully, if I reach out to him, I'll be able to talk to him. But the main thing is not, you know, to talk to him, but to recognize the incredible work that he did in this book. Because what you see here in Blowback is the details behind my theory that my father's job at the FBI to run this program evaluating the application files of 68,000 people As I talked to Wayne Madsen, what, 3 years ago, and his theory was the same, that those represented files of applicants for visas to have entry into the United States, and that they were probably Eastern Europeans. Eastern Europeans means Ukrainians. It means, Baltic states means Poland, means Romania and Bulgaria and all of the states, Hungary, that were formerly part of the Russian Empire and part of what we identify as the Pale, not the Pale in Dublin that the English lived in, but the Pale in Imperial Russia under Catherine the Great, which was the area, the western part of Russia, in which Jews were allowed to live and to create their villages. And the purpose of Catherine of Russia was to develop these lands because they basically were not productive. And so she knew that by bringing Jewish people in, that they would build commerce and build towns, and that it did happen. But of course, there came a time of resentment in which the people who had benefited from this program, the native people of the land, they're Russians or White Russians or whatever ethnicity you want to look at, because it's a huge country. They were elevated over a few generations into the modern economy by virtue of having these Jewish settlements in the Pale. But of course, in the 19th century, then you have the blowback, the pogroms, the persecutions and murders that became the basis of the Russian Revolution. And without trying to get into all of that, I do think that it's important that we recognize that this battle between the Russian desire to have an independent sovereign nation that can do business with Europe, with Western Europe, and the British American NATO Atlantic Council desire to prevent Russia from doing business with Europe because they're claiming the markets for themselves. They're saying, this is our market. You can't have Europe, And that battle for economic dominance of Europe is now being fought by the soldiers on both sides in Ukraine. Why did the United States have this policy of, secretly bringing thousands of Eastern European people who had been collaborators with the Nazis into the United States? It's a huge question. Why did they do it? Why should we have put up with it? Well, it was Eisenhower's decision. I mean, Truman too, but my father joins the FBI in 1949. He spends a year or so in Atlanta and then is transferred to Washington Field Office, the old post office building that is now a Trump Hotel, Trump Tower. And he worked there in the Washington Field Office for almost 10 years. Well, for 10 years, from 51 to 61. And during those 10 years, his first big assignment was from Hoover to oversee the review of these 68,000 files. And my opinion is that those files represented these collaborationist Eastern Europeans, such as the Banderas, such as, the Hungarians and the other Eastern Europeans that had formed collaborationist armies that worked to defeat Russia. I ha hesitate to discuss this without first prefacing the fact that there was far more Ukrainians fighting on the Russian side. They were part of Russia, and millions of Ukrainians fought for Russia in World War II. A very small number of them became Nazi collaborationists. And these are the worst of the worst that would go into the Ukrainian towns, show the SS, you know, commandos where the Jews are, and pick them out. And in some cases, the Nazis, the SS would do it. In some cases, the Ukrainians themselves would murder the Jews in that particular area of Ukraine. And that went on in Hungary and other Poland and other places where the collaborationists were fighting for the Nazis because they did not want the communists to win. They were supported secretly by OSS during World War II. And that is the beginning of the problem. Now, let me read the first thing I wanted to read, which is, hang on. This article from Ordo Ab Keo by David Livingstone, and again, I really do recommend you guys check out this website called ordoabkeo.ca by this very prolific writer, David Livingstone, who I discovered a few months ago. And anyway, so I'm going to go to his section called the Euromaidan, and I will share the screen so you can see what we're reading. This is a subsection of his article in which he calls it the Katetan. The Katetan is a Russian idea of Russia being the third empire after Rome. That Europe, that Russia is now going to be the center of a new European empire. So that theory, of course, goes way back, but part of it is driving the opposition because they don't want to be part of a Russian empire. So is Russia rebuilding an empire? Is there going to be a Eurasian economic community? Well, there is a Eurasian economic community. It just doesn't have a lot of members yet. And they are trying to build a no-trade zone with the European partners that were formerly part of the Soviet bloc. And this is, of course, what NATO is fighting against. So here's a picture of the Euromaidan. And make sure you can see it. Yes, you can. The picture is captioned American Instigated Orange Revolution of late November 2004 to January 2005. Okay. Remember, there's a couple of different revolutions in Ukraine. So let's keep this one in mind as being during that period, 2004-2005. The Orange Revolution. In the last several years, Russia has demonstrated a return to an assertive foreign policy through successful military interventions in Ukraine and Syria. Now, this is written before the Ukraine special military operation that started last year. So this is not, he doesn't know of that that's going to happen when he's writing this. In the Kremlin, Dugin, and remember, Alexander Dugin, the father of the Dugina that got assassinated by a Ukrainian assassin last year, last August. This is her father, Dugin, who is an advisor to Putin. In the Kremlin, Dugin represents the war party, a division within the leadership over Ukraine. He considers the war between Russia and Ukraine to be inevitable and appealed to Putin to start military intervention in the eastern part of the country. Ukraine, as an independent state with certain territorial ambitions, he warns in the Foundations of Geopolitics, represents an enormous danger for all of Eurasia, and without resolving the Ukrainian problem, it is in general senseless to speak about continental politics. Dugin is seen to have been the author of Putin's annexation of Crimea by the Russian Federation in early 2014. According to Yolanta Dartsevska, the Crimea operation has served as an occasion for Russia to demonstrate to the entire world the capabilities and potential of information warfare. The annexation was Russia's response to the Euromaidan revolution, a wave of demonstrations and civil unrest in Ukraine, which began on the night of November 21, 2013 in Kiev. The protests were sparked by Ukrainian government's decision to suspend the signing of an association with the European Union, instead choosing closer ties to Russia and the Eurasian Economic Union. The Russians justified their actions by claiming correctly that the West had backed neo-Nazi elements inside the Ukraine. All right. So a couple of points before we move on. First of all, this is 2004 was the Orange Revolution, and 2013 is the Euromaidan Revolution. Those terms I just need to keep straight in my own mind, because I can confuse them, because this is a number of years apart. This is almost 10 years apart. Okay. The second and most important takeaway is that it was when the Ukraine government decided to suspend the signing of an association agreement with the EU. In other words, the Ukrainian government decided not to fulfill a memorandum of understanding with the European Union that would have brought Ukraine into closer collaboration, at least, with the EU. And they walked away from that in order to go with Russia. Okay? Why did they want to go with Russia instead of the EU? The EU, of course, is the bastion of American democracy. And they walked away from it. They said, no, we'd rather be with the Russians. Why? Now, here's a picture of Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, Victoria Nuland, and Jeffrey Pyatt. The pro-European Union protests were Ukraine's largest since the Orange Revolution of 2004, which saw President Viktor Yanukovych forced to resign. Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, Victoria Nuland, had been closely involved with Ukraine during the Orange Revolution. Nuland enjoyed a friendly meeting with the openly pro-Nazi Svoboda, one of the big three political parties behind the protests. This is despite the fact that Nuland is descended from immigrant Ukrainian Jewish parents, Meyer and Vitya Nudelman, who moved to New York from the Russian Empire. In other words, when Ukraine was part of the Russian Empire. Nuland started in the State Department in the last years of the Soviet Union and served as U.S. ambassador to NATO during George W. Bush's presidency and State Department spokeswoman for Hillary Clinton before becoming Assistant Secretary for Europe under Barack Obama. Nuland was known as one of the most hawkish members of Obama's team when it came to Russia. So, big takeaway number three, Victoria Nuland worked for George W. Bush, okay? Now she's working for Biden. So what changes? The name of the president changes, but the person who is driving our policy in Ukraine doesn't change. She comes from Bush, and now she is in the Democratic administration. Nuland's husband is neoconservative Robert Kagan. Now, I've recently learned that Kagan is a Russian version of Cohen, or the idea of a king. So Kagan means the same thing as Cohn or Cohen. Newland's husband is neoconservative Robert Kagan, who is often dubbed the most prominent representative of modern neoconservative thought on U.S. foreign policy. Kagan is a co-founder of the Neoconservative Project for the New American Century, PNAC, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and a member of the CFR. Kagan was an advisor to John McCain during his presidential campaign in 2008. Kagan's book, The World America Made, disputes the theory that the U.S. has declined as a global superpower. Barack Obama quoted from it several times during his address to the nation in 2012. December 5, 2013, U.S.-Ukraine Foundation Conference, Newland boasted of the U.S.'s role in supporting the protests in the Ukraine. Quote, since Ukraine's independence in 1991, the United States has supported Ukrainians as they build democratic skills and institutions, as they promote civic participation and good governance, all of which are preconditions for Ukraine to achieve its European aspirations. We have invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals that will ensure a secure and prosperous and democratic Ukraine. Events following the Orange Revolution were a terrible disappointment to Newland, especially after Yanukovych returned to power, and she played a central role in his subsequent overthrow in 2014. The Euromaidan protests were sparked by the Ukrainian government's decision to suspend the signing of an association agreement with the European Union, instead choosing closer ties to Russia and the Eurasian Economic Union. The ultranationalists and the extreme right were a small part of the overall campaign, but at times they appeared to be the driving force behind the Maidan. Protesters repeated the cry, "Hail Ukraine! Hail the heroes!" taken from the UPA, one of the two organizations founded by Nazi collaborationist Stefan Bandera. And of course, there's a picture of Bandera that you can see. Protesters repeated the cry, "Hail Ukraine, hail the heroes," taken from the UPA and one of the two organizations founded by Nazi collaborationist Stefan Bandera. Pro-Russian activists claimed, quote, "These people in Kiev are Bandera-following Nazi collaborators." A picture of Yaroslav Stetsko, Philip Crane, Robert Crane, and Professor Lev Dobryansky. In Washington, Bandera's OUN had reconstituted under the banner of the Ukrainian Congress for Committee, under the banner of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, UCCA. You have to understand, we are an underground organization. We have spent years quietly penetrating positions of influence, unquote, one member told Russ Bellant. By the way, Russ Bellant is a author, a journalist, who wrote a important book, which I'm going to refer to a little bit later in the show, about these same collaborationists that came into the United States under these programs, which I described as most likely having been vetted for the FBI by my dad and that committee. By the mid-1980s, the Reagan administration was interwoven with UCCA members, with the group's chairman, Lev Dobryansky, a member of the ASC, that's the American Service Committee, okay, that's a very right-wing group, and the board of the U.S. WACL, W-A-C-L, that is the world, I call them the wacky right-wingers, the Anti-Communist League, the World Anti-Communist League, WACL, you know, that's got all of the far-right people involved in that. So Lev Dobryansky, who is he? As a member of the OSS, Dobryansky worked under Donovan in running many Ukrainian SS officers and their Ukrainian Nazi collaborators to safety in Operation Paperclip. During the Eisenhower administration, Dobryansky initiated Captive Nations, which employed many ex-Nazis and fascists among Eastern European emigres in the United States. Well, there you have it. There they are. They've come in. It's called under Operation Paperclip. We know that technically Operation Paperclip was supposedly only about 1,400 scientists like Wernher von Braun and the great rocket scientists. Well, it's obviously more than that. And to just call it Operation Paperclip without recognizing that, no, this was a lot bigger than those scientists. I think we're past that now. Dobryansky's daughter, Paula, served on the NSC, the National Security Council, and as an assistant director of the defunct U.S. Information Agency during the George H.W. Bush administration. She was also one of the original signatories to Statement of Principles of the Neoconservative PNAC. Project for a New American Century, right? Paula's friend and colleague was Catherine Chumachenko, an American of Ukrainian descent and wife of former Ukrainian President Viktor Yushchenko. Chumachenko had been one of Dobryansky's students. She was a former Reagan administration official and ex-staffer of the Heritage Foundation. Chumachenko was formerly director of the OUN-linked UCCA's Captive Nations Committee, and then deputy director for public liaison at the White House. During the 2004 Ukrainian presidential election campaign, Chumachenko was accused of exerting influence on her husband's decisions as an agent of the U.S. government or even the CIA. In 2010, Yushchenko awarded Stepan Bandera the title of National Hero of Ukraine. On January 1st, 2014, Bandera's 105th birthday was celebrated by a torchlight procession of 15,000 people in the center of Kiev, and thousands more rallied near his statue in Lviv, or Lvov, however you wish to spell it. The march was supported by Svoboda, whose leader, Oleg Tyanybok, had called for liberation of his country from the Muscovite Jewish mafia, quote-unquote. Svoboda is linked to an international network of neo-fascist parties through the Alliance of European National Movements. This alliance's founding members were Jobbik, France's North National Front, Italy's Tricolor Flame, Sweden's National Democrats, and Belgium's National Front. At the end of 2011, Marine Le Pen, the new French National Front leader, resigned from the AENM and joined the European Alliance for Freedom. Svoboda's openly anti-Semitic politics did not prevent Senator John McCain from addressing a Euromaidan rally alongside Tyanybok. In a leaked phone conversation with Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Nuland revealed her wish for Tyanybok to remain, quote, on the outside, unquote, but to consult with the U.S.'s replacement for Yanukovych, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, four times a week. Yatsenyuk became prime minister of Ukraine on February 27, 2014. They discussed then that the UE would not commit to mediate, with Nuland adding, according to a leaked phone conversation, fuck the EU. Okay. Now let's go over to a different reading that I wanted to make this morning. And this will fill out some details and I think opens my mind to a whole lot of resources that are going to help me understand the context in which my dad was placed in charge of those 68,000 files and what was really, who was really pulling the strings in the U.S. government at the time. So this one, let me share that because I think be helpful if you want to read it later or, you know, just stop it and concentrate on the text. You can do that in the replay. This article is called Seven Decades of Nazi Collaboration, America's Dirty Little Ukraine Secret. an interview with Russ Bellant, author of, quote, Old Nazis, the New Right, and the Republican Party, unquote, by Paul Rosenberg. This is his article in the publication Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF. 7 decades of Nazi collaboration. Well, I think this is where we need to read. Let's do it. As the Ukrainian crisis has unfolded over the past few weeks, now this is during the Euromaidan, right, 2013-2014, it's hard for Americans not to see Vladimir Putin as the big villain. But the history of the region is a history of competing villains vying against one another. And one school of villains, the Nazis, have a long history of engagement with the U.S., mostly below the radar, but occasionally exposed, as they were by Russ Bellant in his book, Old Nazis, the New Right, and the Republican Party, printed by South End Press in 1991. And asterisk, I tried to get a copy of it. It cost $300 or $400. So keep an eye out for this book. It's obviously out of print for a reason, because it's saying things that I don't think anybody really wants to be said. Things that my father knew and took to his grave. Bellant's exposure of Nazi leaders from German allies in the 1988 Bush presidential campaign was the driving force in the announced resignation of 9 individuals, 2 of them from Ukraine, which is why he was the logical choice to illuminate the scattered mentions of Nazi and fascist elements among the Ukrainian nationalists, which somehow never seems to warrant further comment or explanation. Of course, most Ukrainians aren't Nazis or fascists. All the more reason to illuminate those who would hide their true natures in the shadows or even behind the momentary glare of the spotlight. And this is an interview, so the question posed by Paul Rosenberg to the author, Russ Bellant. Your book, Old Nazis, the New Right, and the Republican Party, exposed the deep involvement in the Republican Party of Nazi elements from Central and Eastern Europe, including Ukrainian, dating back to World War II and even before. As the Ukrainian crisis unfolded in the last few weeks, there have been scattered mentions of a fascist or neo-fascist element, but somehow that never seems to warrant further comment or explanation. I can't think of anyone better to shed light on what's not being said about that element. The danger of Russian belligerence is increasingly obvious, but this unexamined fascist element poses dangers of its own. What can you tell us about this element and those dangers? Remarkable, isn't it, in 2014 that those questions were posed, and now we are facing the literal answers of it in a World War I trench warfare of 1,000 kilometers long, in which hundreds of guys are getting killed every day. That is the result of us not studying and not reasoning and not using critical thinking skills to prevent this war. Okay, here's his answer. The element has a long history, of a long record that speaks for itself, when that record is actually known and elaborated on. The key organization in the coup that took place here recently was the OUN, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or a specific branch of it known as the Banderas, the OUN-B. They're the group behind the Svoboda Party, which got a number of key positions in the new interim regime. The OUN goes back to the 1920s, when they split off from other groups, and especially in the 1930s, began a campaign of assassinating and otherwise terrorizing people who didn't agree with them. Do we not have a reflection of that now in the hit list of the Ukrainian government against journalists, such as our friends at the Schiller Institute? Yeah, assassinating and terrorizing people who don't agree with them. As World War II approached, they made an alliance with the Nazi powers. They formed several military formations so that when Germany invaded the Soviet Union in June 1941, they had several battalions that went into the main city at the time where their base was, Lvov or Lvov, as it has a plenty of spellings, also Lviv. They went in, and there's a documented history of them participating in the identification and rounding up of Jews in that city and assisting in executing several thousand citizens almost immediately. They were also involved in liquidating Polish group populations in other parts of Ukraine during the war. Without getting deeply involved in their whole history, the OUN to this day defend their wartime role. They were backers of forming the 14th Waffen-SS Division, which was the all-Ukrainian division that became an armed element on behalf of the Germans and under overall German control. They helped encourage its formation, and after the war, right after the end of the war, it was called the 1st Ukrainian Division. And they still glorify that history of that SS division, and they have a veterans organization that obviously doesn't have too many of its members left, but they formed a veterans division of that. If you look at insignia being worn in Kiev in the street demonstrations and marches to the SS division insignia still being worn. In fact, I was looking at photographs last night of it, and there was a whole formation marching, not with the 14th Division, but with the 2nd Division. It was a large division that did major battle around the Ukraine, and these marchers were wearing the insignia on the armbands of the 2nd Division. So this is a very clear record, and the OUN, even in its post-war publications, has called for ethnogenetically pure Ukrainian territory. Ethnogenetically pure. They put the word genetic now because, you know, genetics has now superseded the study of eugenics. But it's the same damn thing, isn't it? Ethnogenetically pure Ukrainian territory. Which, of course, is simply calling for purging Jews and Poles and Russians from what they consider Ukrainian territory. Also, current leaders of Svoboda have made blatantly anti-Semitic remarks that call for getting rid of Muscovite Jews and so forth. They use this very coarse, threatening language that anybody knowing the history of World War II would tremble at. If they were living here, it would seem like they would start worrying about it. Obviously, these people don't hold monopoly power in Ukraine, but they stepped up, and the United States has been behind the Svoboda Party and these Ukrainian nationalists. In fact, the U.S. connections to them go back to World War II, and the United States has had a long-standing tie to the OUN through the intelligence agencies, initially military intelligence and later the CIA. Question. Your book discusses a central figure in the OUN, Yaroslav Stetsko, who was politically active for decades here in America. What can you tell us about his history? And the answer. Yaroslav Stetsko was the number two leader of the OUN during World War II and thereafter. In 1959, Stefan Bandera, who was head of the OUN, was killed, and that's why when Stetsko assumed the leadership. Stetsko in 1941 was the guy who actually marched into Lvov with the German army on June 30th, 1941, and the OUN issued a proclamation at that time under his name, praising and calling for glory to the German leader Adolf Hitler and how they're going to march arm in arm for the Ukraine and so forth. After the war, he was part of the key leadership that got picked up by the Americans. There's a number of accounts I've seen, at least three credible reports, on how they were in the displaced persons camp. The Allied forces set up DP camps and picked up tens of thousands of these former allies of Hitler from countries all over the East, Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania. There weren't Polish collaborators, I think. Most people know the Germans heavily persecuted and murdered millions of Polish residents, but Bulgaria, Romania, Croatia, and so forth, Belorussia, that's White Russia, or Belarus today. They had them in these camps they built and organized them, where the Ukrainians were assassinating their Ukrainian nationalist rival so that they would be the undisputed leaders of Ukrainian nationalist movement, so they would get the sponsorship of the United States to continue their political operation. And they were successful in that regard. So when Bandera was out of the picture, Stetsko became the undisputed leader of the Ukrainian nationalists. The OUN in 1943, under German sponsorship, organized a multinational force to fight on behalf of the retreating German army. After the Battle of Stalingrad in 43, the Germans felt a heightened need to get more allies, and so the Romanian Iron Guard, the Hungarian Arrow Cross, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, and others with military formations in place to assist came together and formed the United Front called the Committee of Subjugated Nations, and again worked on behalf of the German military. In 1946, they renamed it the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, the ABN. Stetsko was the leader of that until he died in 1986. I mention this in part because the OUN tries to say, well, during the war we fought the Germans and the communists. The fact of the matter is that they were the leadership of this whole multinational alliance on behalf of the Germans the last 2 years of the war and thereafter. And in the war thereafter, all the post-war leaders of the unrepentant national Nazi allies were all under the leadership of Jaroslav Stetsko. Question, what happened when Stetsko and others like him from other German allied forces came to the United States? Answer, in the United States, when they came, his groups organized, quote, captive nations committees. They became supposedly the representatives of people who are being oppressed in Eastern Europe, the Baltic countries, by the Soviets. But they were, in fact, being given an uncritical blank check to represent the voices of all these nations that were part of the Warsaw Pact, when, in fact, they represented the most extreme elements of each of the national communities. The Captive Nations Committee in Washington, D.C., for instance, was run by the person who headed the Ukrainian Organization of Nationalists. That was true in a number of places, in my hometown area near Detroit as well. They played a major role. In the early 50s, when they were resettled in the United States, there were at least 10,000 of them that were resettled. Hear this? Tens of thousands. Again, at least 10,000. That resonates with the 68,000 figure. Again, circumstantial, but building evidence toward my theory. They became politically active through the Republican National Committee because it was really the Eisenhower administration that made the policy decision in the early 1950s and brought them in. Well, there you have it. You know, my dad joins the FBI, comes to Washington in 51, or perhaps 50, but, you know, right around there when Truman is out and Eisenhower comes in. And it's Eisenhower that says to Alan Dulles at the CIA, yes, you're okay, I won't object. You can bring these people in. And these people being the ones we've been talking about, the collaborationist army leaders that fought for the Nazis and murdered the Jews and the Poles and the Russians and the rest. Those people. So, and this is all, you know, again, I have to just give great credit to Christopher Simpson's book, Blowback, because it's so well documented in here. And, you know, I read that book thoroughly and underlined and highlighted hundreds of passages. It's very, very important book to understanding what is really a part of American history that we need to know, that we were supporting the Nazis and we still are. So, through the Republican National Committee, they became active because they made these committees in various cities. Chicago stands out to me, but all around the country, of these people that are really the extreme right wing of their countries, but are pretend are allowed to act as though they represent the people of those countries, these oppressed nations of Eastern Europe, when in fact they don't. They really are pursuing an agenda of their own racist nationalist ideologies with the support of American government secretly, as Eisenhower just goes out and plays golf, and all these things happen. They set up these campaign organizations. Every 4 years, they would mobilize for the Republican candidate, whoever it would be. And some of them, like Richard Nixon in 1960, actually had close direct ties to some of the leaders, like the Romanian Iron Guard and some of these other groups. When Richard Nixon ran for president in 1968, he made a promise to these leaders that they would, if he won the presidency, he would make them the ethnic outreach arm of the Republican National Committee on a permanent basis. So they wouldn't be a quadrennial presence, but a continuing presence in the Republican Party. And he made them pro made that promise through a guy named Laszlo Pastor, who served 5 years in prison after World War II for crimes against humanity. He was prosecuted in 1946 by non-communist government that actually had control of Hungary at the time. There was a period from 45 to 48 when Hungarian Communist Party didn't run Hungary. They were the ones who prosecuted him. He had served as a liaison between the Hungarian Nazi Party and Berlin. He served in the Berlin embassy of the Hungarian Arrow Cross movement. This is the guy that got picked to organize all the ethnic groups, and the only people that got brought in were the Nazi collaborators. They didn't have a Russian affiliate because they hated all Russians of all political stripes. There were no African Americans or Jewish affiliates either. It was just composed of these elements. And for a while, they had a German affiliate, but some exposure of the Nazi character of the German affiliate caused it to be quietly removed. But other Nazi elements were retained. Your book was researched and published in the 1980s. What was happening by that point of time after these groups had been established for more than a decade? Good question. I went to their meetings in the 1980s and they pulled out material that make really clear who they were. 1984, one of their 1984 booklets praised the pro-Nazi Ustashi regime in Croatia. And these Ustashi killed an estimated 750,000 people and burned them alive in their own camp in Croatia. And here they are praising the founding of this regime and acknowledging that it was associated with the Nazis and it was signed by the chairman of the Ra Republican National Committee. You couldn't make this stuff up. It was just crazy. I interviewed this Cossack guy. He showed me his pension from the service in the SS in World War II and how he was affiliated with free Nazi groups in the United States. And he was just very unrepentant. These are the umbrellas that were called captive nations committees by these people that Stetsko was over and was part of too. The Reagan White House brought him in and promoted him as a major leader and did a big dinner. UN Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick was part of it. George Bush was vice president. Of course, Reagan, and Stetsko was held up as a great leader. And proclamations were issued on his behalf. When Bush was running for president in 1988, Bush Sr., he came to these basically one of these leading locations of the Ukrainian nationalists in North America, which is just outside of Detroit. Hello, Dave. A suburb of Detroit to their cultural center. And one of their foremost leaders in the world is headquartered out of there at that time. He got Bush to come there and they denounced the OSI. And Bush just shook his head and he wouldn't say anything about it. The OSI was the Office of Special Investigations. It was investigating the presence of Nazi war criminals in the United States and deporting those that were found to have lied on their history when they applied to come into the United States after the war. They had deported a number of people from all over the United States. They had a lot of open investigations, and all these emigre Nazis were trying to bring all the political pressure they could to stop these investigations, including the Ukrainian nationalist ones. So they denounced them, the OSI investigations, in front of Bush. Bush nodded his head, but he wouldn't say anything because he didn't want to sound like he was sympathetic to the Nazi war criminals. But at the same time, he didn't want to offend his hosts by disputing the issue with them. So the issue of World War II was still being played out over four decades later in the politics of the presidency. And unfortunately, Bush and Reagan continued to be on the side that we tried to defeat in World War II. Let's skip down because we're running out of time. What's happened since you wrote your book? Answer. Once the OUN got sponsored by American security establishment intelligence agencies, they were embedded in a variety of ways in Europe as well, like Radio Free Europe, which is headquartered in Munich. A lot of these groups in the ABN were headquartered in Munich under the sponsorship of Radio Free Europe. From there, they ran various kinds of operations where they were trying to do work inside the Warsaw Pact countries. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, a number of them moved back into the Ukraine, as well as other respective countries, and began setting up operations there and organizing political parties. They reconstituted the veterans group of the Waffen-SS. They held marches in the 1990s in the Ukraine and organized political parties in alliance with the United States and became part of what was called the Orange Revolution in 2004. When they won the election there. The prime minister was closely allied with them. They worked with the new government to get veterans benefits for the Ukrainian SS Division veterans. And they started establishing the statues and memorials and museums for Stepan Bandera, who was the leader of the OUN and who I should say was despised by other Ukrainian nationalists because of their methods. Because they were extreme and violent toward other rival Ukrainian nationalist groups as well. So Bandera wasn't a universal hero, but this group was so influential because of its U.S. connections that if you go online and you Google Lviv and the word Bandera, you'll see monuments and statues and large posters and banners of Bandera's likeness and large monuments, permanently erected monuments on behalf of Bandera. So they made this guy like he's the George Washington of the Ukraine. I don't believe it's ever too late to become familiarized and educated about the history of this phenomenon, both the wartime history and our post-war collaboration with these folks. There were a number of exposés written about the emigre Nazis. There was a 1979 book called Wanted, and it did a number of case stories of these people being brought into the United States, including the Trefa story. Christopher Simpson did a book called Blowback that discussed the policy decisions. It's an incredible book. He's a professor at American University, and he did years of research through the Freedom of Information Act and archives and got the policy documents under which the decisions were made to bring these folks together, and not just into the United States, but to deploy them around the world. Like my book, it didn't get the attention it deserved. The New York Times book reviewer was negative toward the book. There are people that really don't want to touch this stuff. There's a lot of people who don't want it touched. I think it's really important for people who believe in openness and transparency and democratic values who don't want to see hate groups come back to power in other parts of the world to know what happened. There's not very many Americans that really even know that the Waffen-SS was a multinational force. That's been kind of kept out of the received history. Otherwise, people would know that there were Ukrainian Nazis, Hungarian Nazis, Latvian Nazis, and they were all involved in the mass murder of their fellow citizens, if they were Jewish, or even if they were co-nationalists that were on the other side of the issue in the war. They were just mass murderers across Eastern Europe, and that history, those facts aren't even well known. A lot of people didn't even know that this phenomenon existed. So that's my content for this morning. is to say Victoria Nuland is carrying on a tradition that goes back to World War II, that the powers that be in the United States are driving this policy, that her actions were under the Bush administration, and then they were under the Clinton administration, and then they were under the Obama, and then they were under the Biden administration. The one person that would not abide with her was Donald Trump. And, of course, that is the dividing line today in our country. Those that would support the Democratic Party, even though they know or should have known or should know of its links to the Nazis, versus those that would support Donald Trump, despite knowing his history or knowing enough to suspect of his connections to various groups behind the scenes. America is given a choice between two parties. The Republican Party clearly got invaded by these Ukrainian and Eastern European collaborationist armies personnel. But you see, when Victoria Nuland carries through with the Clinton administration, we see that it's no longer, the Democratic Party is no longer opposed to what's happening with the Republican Party. And here you have the real distinction in America today is between those elites and their followers and their sycophants and their parasites who want to support the fascist, nationalist, socialist ideals versus those that want to support the Constitution and the idea of individual rights and individual freedoms as being the highest function of government is to protect our individual rights and freedoms. Neither side appears to me to be really invested in the good of the common people of this country, and both sides appear to have been deeply infiltrated by the commercial interests, the banks and the banksters, and those who involve themselves in secret manipulations, in overthrows, in genocide, in mass murder, and collaborate with those people. So, I appreciate our authors, David Livingstone and this new man who I need to investigate more. His name is Russ Bellant, B-E-L-L-A-N-T. And I'm going to see if I can find a copy of that book of his, Old Nazis, the New Right, and the Republican Party. The fact is that neither of our parties is working for the people of the United States, no matter what they say. They're all, both are collaborationists with the powers behind the scenes. And that'll be the show for today. Thanks again. Bye now.